And so I think really what I've come to understand after a period of feeling that maybe I had to lose it or let it go is that I'm only going to be successful if I embrace it 100%. That's my superpower. And I think all creative people, if you're ever thinking this is a distraction or something like that, no, it's not. You must embrace it because it is your superpower too.
Hey there. Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your fellow student and host. In this episode, I spoke with Sasha Schechter, an Emmy Award-winning TV producer. Sasha talks about her early interests in writing, music, and storytelling, and how she wound up pursuing a career as a television producer. She pivoted into the business world a few years ago, and she also shares perspectives on how awareness and appreciation for both creative and business goals can lead to better outcomes, whether it be in the business world or in the arts. I hope you enjoy this episode. All right. Well, Sasha, thank you so much for being here. Welcome. I'm so excited to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here too.
Cool. Well, I would love to start by taking you back to your childhood, thinking about Sasha as a child around age 7, 8, 9. And as you think about yourself around that age, how did creativity come out?
Oh, I love this question. I love thinking back. I think creativity is at its best when we're young because we're so unself-conscious. We're just so, you know, kids have thoughts and they say them. And it's, you know, so it's hilarious. It's amazing. It's inspiring to me. So I love thinking back to this time of life when we weren't so worried all the time about everything. But I think, you know, around that age, 7, 8, 9, there was always music in my family. My uncle Rob was this brilliant pianist and he was a vocal coach and he worked with everyone from people who just wanted to learn to sing to Broadway actors who were actually working. And so I think when I was around that age, I decided that, you know, oh, I should take piano lessons, like all my friends are taking piano lessons. And I started to learn piano and I was not made for the piano. It didn't speak to me. I was not good. And I got really frustrated by it. So he was the one that suggested that we try voice lessons instead. Why don't you try singing? And so I started to sing and I got really excited about singing and really into practicing singing. Again, not very naturally gifted at it. I had really good pitch. I had all of the makings of a singer, but I was not like my voice, my muscles in my throat were not like naturally gifted at singing. So I had to work really, really hard at it. And I loved working really, really hard at it. And it was so much fun just to sort of express myself through music and through song, and picking my own songs was like such a joy. I loved doing it. So I felt like a little rock star in my life. And that was really wonderful. But, you know, beyond that, I danced as well. I think, you know, every little kid wants to go to ballet at some point. So I did that when I was little. But by the time I was 12, I would go to school in the day. And then I would go to dance school in the evening. And I did everything: ballet, jazz, tap, modern, wow. Just everything. I was like, if I can try it, like, put me in, coach. I'm ready to give it a go. And I think, again, not, you know, did not have a ballerina's physique, but I loved it. I just thought, like, the physical expression tied to the music was amazing. So I spent so many hours just doing music, doing dance, and thinking I was going to be on Broadway because I was growing up in New York City, and that was just what I wanted to do. But then as I got older, you know, and you, again, when you're 7, 8, 9, you're so unself-conscious. You're so just happy to be there. But as I got older, I think I started to understand who I was relative to some of these other, frankly, professional level dancers. Because in New York City, there's no such thing as casual creativity. It's like professional or nothing. So I started writing more and sort of like focusing my time on crafting stories and using the written word and reading books and living life in stories. And so that's when I think maybe my creativity actually came most sharply into focus, was when I figured out that I really loved writing.
I love that. That was going to be my next question, because you wound up deciding to study creative writing, right?
Yes.
So talk about that a little bit. Like, how did you kind of hone that focus? And also, like you were saying, interest in reading. So were there certain like authors that grabbed you and inspired you?
Yeah, I think when I started writing, it was sort of like as a tool to process my day, or to process, you know, when something was hard, or I, you know, had a fight with a friend or a trouble with family or whatever it was, I would just start writing about it, and not like journaling writing, which by the way, I'm a big fan of, and I think everybody should do it, but sort of like rewriting what I went through from the perspective of a character. I would sort of, I would tell the story of what had happened to me. And that felt very cathartic. Like it was a way to kind of put the situation to bed, or to let it go, or to just process it, get some closure, and then move on. And I think that that's sort of how I started it. And then I realized, like, oh, I don't have to just stick to what happened. I could create scenarios. Like I could invent a story. And so I just started playing. It's kind of like, how do I say this? I think, like I was saying earlier, when I sang and I danced, I loved doing it and I loved working really hard at trying to get good at it. But writing was something that it is like a very different relationship for me of like with writing. It was something that I kind of couldn't shut off. Like if I was riding the subway to go to school, I was like writing a story about the person sitting across from me, or like describing the color of their shoes in a particular way. Like, and to this day, there's always words in my head. It's just constantly going. So it was more something that I had this like energy that I kind of had to do it. It wasn't that I wanted to do it the way with my other creative endeavors, but this was just something that I couldn't not write it down. Even like to prepare for this podcast, I like wrote a bunch of things down. Not to like, I'm not reading a script right now, but it's like, this is just how my brain works.
How you process.
Yeah, like I've got to write it down. And I think to your question about reading, there's so many, it's hard to like, I hate when people say like, who's your favorite author or what's your favorite book? I'm like, do not ask me that. That is not fair.
That wasn't going to be on my questions, just so you know.
And I appreciate you for it, because it's just, it's not possible. But like having moments of dialogue in any book. When I go see theater, I love to see all kinds of theater, because whether it's the greatest thing you've ever seen or maybe the worst thing you've ever seen, there's going to be a moment in it that you will appreciate, whether because it taught you, oh, I would never have done that. If I ever get a chance to create something like this, I won't do that. Or you see something and you say, gosh, that moved me so profoundly. Why? What was it about that moment? How do I emulate that in my own work? And I think with books, it's the same. I mean, I would read anything, everything that I could. And you find these moments of dialogue or this moment of description that it grabs you. And I was more fascinated by that than by sort of having like an allegiance to any one particular book or author. It's this desire just to experience more of whatever it is and just take it all in. And that was very much sort of how I approached reading and writing.
That's such a good attitude towards approaching any book or, you know, movie, like you said, of like, what can I take from it or learn from it, instead of like, do I like it? Do I not like it? You know, it's like a much more growth oriented mindset, yeah. Which is awesome.
Well, and I'll say, when I was younger, that was my mindset 100%. Now, you know, it's to me, opening a new book, it's such a tall order now. It makes me sad. Like I'm sharing this in a spirit of sadness that like, it's so hard for me to get into a book now. But again, when you're in that younger stage where you're just like, you're so curious and you're so hungry, you're like a sponge and you're taking it all in. Oh boy, do I miss that. So maybe this podcast will inspire me to reframe it.
Yeah, let's bring back that energy. I love it. Okay, a couple things. One, I think it's so interesting that you tried a couple of different types of like singing, piano, music, dance, and then landed at writing. You know, I feel like people that try like multiple sports before specializing or multiple types of art, you know, kind of helps them go deeper into the one that they ultimately choose and bring some elements from those other areas into it. So that's one thing that's pretty interesting. And then I think secondly, I love your description of using of like feeling the energy pull to writing versus like needing to cultivate a practice discipline where like you probably naturally did that because you were just so eager and hungry to write.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, yes. Like when you hear artists talk about how much practice goes in and how you have to, you know, build the practice muscle, and you do, by the way, right? Like, you know, now that I'm, again, I have a corporate job, I have bills to pay, I have all these, you know, wonderful adult responsibilities. Exactly. You know, that's where you have to cultivate a practice. Otherwise, it falls off the to-do list immediately. But yeah, there's something to be said about what you don't have to try to practice. that's really good information. Like, how, like, when you just gravitate to doing something, listen to that. I think that, you know, I think when we're older, I know we'll talk about business later, but especially like in a career path, right? Like, finding that energy, again, when you're young, you're unselfconscious. This is one version of it. But like, I think there are ways to do it as an adult as well. And I'm still, you know, I think we're all always in search of that, and allowing that to present itself to you as well, not overthinking things. Because I think if I had overthought writing, the truth is, like I was saying, I had to work really hard to be good at singing. I also had to work really hard to be good at writing, but I was so...
Didn't notice it.
I didn't notice it. Exactly. I was just doing it because it made me so happy to be doing it.
That's so cool. I love that. Did you find that you pulled anything? I mean, there are different art forms, but so did you find that you pulled anything from music, singing, dance into writing?
Oh, yes.
Oh, talk about that. Tell me.
Absolutely. Because, yes, I would love to. Yes, because really great music, in my opinion, tells a story. And it doesn't have to be through the lyric. It doesn't have to be through, you know, some explicit design of a dance show. But I think when music really moves you, it's because it's taken you on some kind of journey. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And really good writing, it almost sounds obvious, right? But when you're reading a good book, part of what makes a book so great is that it has a beginning, a middle, and end. It has a fully formed arc of some kind, whether it's, you know, abstract or it's poetry where maybe nothing has happened. It's more of a musing. The point is that you've completed some kind of emotional journey here. And so to me, that's like the common thread, is that through any music piece, any music performance, any physical expression of music, and any story that you're telling, it's about that journey. Where did I start and where did I end? And am I a different person at the end of this? And I think if you can accomplish that, then you've won, regardless of what your art is. But for me, I think that's what made them to me the same. They were the same thing.
Awesome. Well, so you wound up pursuing a path of producing and making documentaries. So could you talk a little bit about how you found yourself on that path from the creative writing?
So I actually didn't pursue this. I think I sort of fell backwards into it, which is a common theme, I think, throughout a lot of people's careers, right? It's sort of, you know, you're going to have a plan, you're going to have ambition, you're going to have like, oh, this is what I'd love to do. And I think it's in those moments of openness to what opportunity is in front of you is where, so to speak, the magic can happen. And I think producing was one of those situations. So I was about to finish college. I majored in creative writing. I had this incredible 4 years at Oberlin College. Shout out to Oberlin. This extremely creative place that I loved with my whole mind, body, and soul. And I had to get a job, and I was trying to figure out what that job was going to be. I really wanted to write, but I was starting to get cold feet about what it meant to be an artist in the real world, so to speak. I didn't know how I was going to get an apartment or pay bills if I was doing that. So I started trying to find anything that would sort of like check the creativity box, but also would give me a steady paycheck. And so one of the first internships I did was for a marketing agency. I thought, well, marketing, that's writing, that's creative, but it would be a paycheck. So I said, let me give it a go. I'll do an internship. And it was fine. I was not feeling that, like we were talking about, that sort of magnetic energy. I didn't feel it. I sort of knew that it wasn't the right space for me. And in that regard, I'm really glad that I did it. And essentially through, you know, the power of the network, you know, heard through the grapevine that Channel 13, which is PBS in New York City, they needed an intern to backfill a sort of entry-level employee who had just been promoted into a new position. But they needed someone to come for the summer and sort of fill what they were already doing. And I kind of just threw my hat in the ring and I said, you know, I'm available. I had to resign from the internship, so I wasn't actually available. But I was like, I can be available. You just call me if it makes sense. And they did that. So I, you know, sort of just wound up in the middle of the summer leaving one internship and starting this new one within public television. And I was a research assistant for the CEO, and which basically meant I spent my days doing research to inform pitches for new programs. Like if we wanted to do a documentary about this institution in New York City, like what's the story there and how would we pitch it to get funding for it? And so that's what I did for a whole summer, basically, was, and I, you know, worked a little bit on a news show while I was there. And really, again, it wasn't on my bingo card to work in television, but this opportunity presented itself. I wound up in it and I had so much fun. The people were kind. Everyone was smart. It had that creative energy that I was looking for. And I was writing. I was pitching the stories. What's the story? What's the human angle behind a building? What's the story that we could tell? Write it down in one page and let's see if we can get funding for it. So long story long, you know, I did this internship. I fell in love with it. I applied to many, many, many jobs there. It was kind of hard to get a foot in the door, but eventually I got hired into a different position, not producing, which I did for several years before I thought, you know what? Why don't I just go for it? I'm here. Like, why not? If I'm in a TV station, why not try to be a TV producer? And I was really, really lucky to have the boss that I had as a producer. She sort of said, yeah, let me give you a shot. I know you've got no experience, but I know you got the goods. So let's see if you can do it.
That's amazing. Wow, what an incredible journey. And yeah, to your point, like sometimes these things aren't planned, right? You find yourself in them. And it's also interesting that you kind of found yourself in yet another creative outlet and form of creative expression, which, you know, wasn't, I mean, it, you know, obviously required a lot of writing, but wasn't explicitly just writing. But you're also bringing in like the visual element.
Exactly. Well, and again, it's like the through line is the story. How do you tell a good story? If you know how to tell a good story, like my thesis statement for life is like, if you know how to tell a good story, you're going to be good. Like whether it's business, it's creativity, it's, you know, surviving your family reunion. You need a good story and you're going to be okay. So that was the through line through TV as well.
That's a good life thesis. I like it. Okay, so when in your time as a producer, like how could you take us through, you know, maybe a program or a documentary that you're proud of and take us through kind of like end to end what the process looked like?
Ooh, I love that. Yes. So what's interesting about working in, I'm going to say network, quote unquote, you know, if anyone here is a public television nerd, they'll know that PBS is not a network. But when you're in an environment where you're creating content for sort of a larger entity, a lot of the time you don't actually get to pick what you're producing, right? So you don't necessarily come up with the idea of what the story is that you're going to tell or what's the focus of the documentary. Sometimes it happens. I will say I did get to pitch an original idea for something called Facebook Watch, which, you know, I guess 100 years ago at this point, Facebook was going to throw its hat in the content ring. And so they had created this part of Facebook called Facebook Watch. And the idea was going to be that you could watch shorter form content within Facebook as a platform, just to kind of keep you in their ecosystem, I guess, which, you know, it's funny now to think about Instagram, TikTok, all these, you know, obviously it went in a very different direction. But back at that time, that was the bet that they were making. So I pitched an original series to them called Dog People, which was just going to be all about dog people, exactly as it sounds, like sort of telling funny stories about New Yorkers and their dogs. Anyway, that got picked up and we did get to make a few episodes and that was really fun. But I would say that's the exception, not the rule, is when you get to kind of pitch it and make it happen. So, you know, kind of back to your original question, you know, maybe you receive the research assistant, whoever that is at the time, whether it was me or somebody else, we effectively pitched an idea for a program. That program gets assigned to a producer. And from there, you got to get smart really quick, right? Because you might be receiving something that you've never heard of before, or maybe it's a person you're not familiar with, or, you know, maybe it's something you are familiar with, but you don't know the whole story behind it. And now it's your job. That's what you're working towards, is at the end of the day, you got to put something on TV that's going to tell the story the right way. So lots of research. How do I get smart? What are the books I need to read? What are the, you know, are the people who are the focus of this film on YouTube somewhere? Can I see what they've already said? Just as much research as you possibly can, which I was really used to from writing, because when you're writing, obviously you can never know enough. You need to know everything in order to embody everything or anything when you need it. So I loved that sort of initial research period of just like, okay, what do I have to know so that I can tell this story with authority? From there, it's usually an outline of sorts, right? Like, you know, okay, what essentially, if I've got to get us from point A to point B on this map, what are all the different shots that I need to get? Who are the folks I need to interview? What kinds of information do I need to pull from them when I'm interviewing them? So just sort of like a, you know, on paper, what is this going to look like? You know, again, sketching out how I'm going to get from point A to point B and all the different stops I need to make in between. And once you kind of have that in place, then you start to get to the really fun stuff, which is actually booking the shoots, booking the interviews, reaching out to people and saying, hey, this is what we're working on. when can we show up in your house with a camera and some lights and some makeup and let's make some magic happen. Once you've got your shoots scheduled and everything, going out on them, sitting with these people and sort of like asking them the right questions to get to the right story is so much fun. I mean, this is like, a producer is not an introvert's job. Let me put it that way. Like, you've got to really kind of show up that day and you're kind of the captain of this team. Like, all right, I got to set the right tone. I've got to make sure I'm prepared. I need to know my stuff so that, you know, you never want to ask a question you don't already at least somewhat know the answer to. You want to be as prepared as possible because it's one thing to have coffee with someone and just learn about them. It's another thing to be very targeted in your questions and say, I need to tell this part of the story. And so I need you to speak to that as effectively as I can get you to. Having the ability to ask the question multiple different ways, make people feel very comfortable. You know, I'm telling you this, Jenna, but you're a wonderful interviewer for your podcast. So like,
oh, stop. Thank you.
You get it, right? It's like, if you don't set the tone right, then the rest of it doesn't fall into place. So that was always really, really fun. I loved doing the interviews. It was so, I would always get so nervous because to me, it was like a mini performance almost. You know, I wanted them to love talking to the camera. I wanted them to be so happy that they took the time to do this. So I took it so, so seriously. And it was really, really fun.
There is like a lot of art that goes into it because you're like simultaneously needing to think about the next question and listen. So then it's like, do you listen? Do you not? Do you take a time out? Look at that. You know, it's
absolutely.
And your mind can process so much more than what's actually being said in the conversation. Right. But so how do you stay present? It's on like a meta level. It's like kind of fascinating.
It is fascinating. I feel like a neurologist should like put the, you know, the trackers on a producer's brain while they're giving an interview. Because everything you just said is so true. I mean, the sheer volume of things going through your head while you are also very actively.
Yeah, because you're also thinking about the shoot and.
Right. What does it look like? Is the audio right? Which, of course, you have all these, at least when I was a producer, we had all these wonderful people hired that was their whole focus, right? The sound person was going to worry about the sound. I didn't have to worry about that, but I worried about it anyway. And also, again, like you're saying, okay, they're answering this question in this way. How do I phrase my next question so that it's continuous? And anyway, the neurologist should really track what's going on in the brain when a producer is doing an interview, because I think it's probably hysterical. I'd love to see like the brainwaves going off the charts. But so yes, once you kind of get through the interviews and you've collected all of your footage, you've done B-roll shots, which if you're not familiar with B-roll, is essentially if someone's talking, but you're looking at something that isn't them talking, that footage is B-roll. So you need lots of it. You never know when you need to cover somebody's you know, misspeak or someone's, you know, taking a breath or something, and you just need to cover a cut in the footage. You want to have plenty of options. And you need to have enough footage of what this story is about, because you can't make a documentary if you don't have the footage. How do I say this? You have to write to what you have, right? So if you only have footage of dogs, you're not going to make a documentary about cats. So you need to make sure that you've got enough of what you need to tell this story. So that process was always very fun, sometimes a little stressful. I had a really great colleague once who told me, if you get budget for 5 shoots, use 4 of them and make sure you always have one on the back burner so that when you realize what you didn't get, you still have an opportunity to go and get it. You know, you want to always just be prepared and ready and expecting anything to happen that you're just going to need one more chance to go out in the field. So I always took that to heart and tried to do that. And then I really think where it starts to all come to life is when you start writing the script, which for me, ironically, was always the most stressful part, probably because I took it so seriously. I wanted to do it so well. But ultimately, once you get in the edit room and you start understanding, what have we got? What have we put in here? What does the script sound like relative to what my talking heads are saying and everything like that? And once you start seeing it come to life, that's when you kind of massage, and it's the sort of relaxing from following just your script and understanding like in the moment organically what's presenting to you as the best possible story. Let that guide what it is. So I always loved working in the edit room. I was really lucky to have full-time editors. I was not, you know, a triple threat producer where you know, you have to write, shoot, and edit. That was not the job that I had. And thank goodness it wasn't, because I loved working with editors who that was really their art, their craft, and could kind of help me shape this into the story that it needed to be. So that collaborative portion is also, I think, such a gift when you're making something like a documentary.
That is so cool. That's what a fascinating process.
It was fun. And, you know, I think probably if you talk to anyone who's made a film, they're going to have a different process. You know, it's fun to talk to filmmakers who don't work within the context, again, of like a quote unquote network, who are making their own films and what's their process like. I think it's probably so different In the same way that, you know, if you talk to a journalist who's writing content for a newspaper, you know, that writing process will be different from someone who's writing their first novel, because you're kind of going about it for different outcomes or different end goals. And anyway, so that's my process. But, you know, what a cool experience.
What's so interesting is you said, you know, you'd write the script after filming. Like, how often did it change where going in, you know, you have one story and then after you do the filming, you realize, oh, you know what, the real story is here.
Yeah, I would say more often than not. And, you know, when I studied creative writing in college, I really studied nonfiction, which I loved because there's so much poetry in real life. You know, there's so much that you discover in real life that I think can be so much more impactful than inventing circumstances. And I'm sure a fiction writer would fight me on that, and I would love it. Please call me. Let's have a debate. But with documentary making, I think it's exactly what you said, that you have a vision in your head. You know, you kind of start from the end of what's the outcome I'm hoping for? What's the story I'm hoping to tell? But you're going to uncover things throughout the process that you simply didn't expect that are going to be oftentimes way better than what was in your head. And sometimes it's also not as good as what was in your head. And that's where you have to really sort of practice embracing what it is. Like, okay, this is what, again, you got to write to what you have. This is what I have. What is the best story that I can tell given what's here in front of me? And again, sometimes it's better than what you had planned for because you can't actually know the answer to every question you're going to ask. And that's where the joy and the fun really kicks in.
Well, it's really cool of like detaching yourself from the outcome. You have to be open to following it versus being like, no, I'm going to stick to my original idea.
Yeah, totally. And it's like how I got into producing in the first place. Like I had this vision of what I was going to do and I was completely wrong. And I was just open to what was there. It's such a skill.
It is.
I'm still practicing it, but I think
it's one we have to keep learning.
Yeah, over and over again. And every time something really fun happens from that experience, it's like more incentive to just remember to do it. So
you wound up winning an Emmy for one of the documentaries that you worked on. What was that experience like of working on something that won, ultimately resulted in an Emmy?
Yeah. So the Emmy was for a program that I worked on. It was actually not a documentary. It was a news magazine program called SciTech Now with Hari Srinivasan. And this program was about science and technology innovation happening across the United States. What I loved about the show was sort of the opportunity to work with lots of different PBS stations across the country and see what they were producing and understand some of the stories happening in their local areas. So imagine working with, you know, the North Carolina station that's in the Research Triangle. I wasn't a scientist. I you know, barely knew about a lot of the things that I wound up producing stories around or producing interviews around. And I think that's what made that program so fun and exciting for me, was a lot of brand new information all the time. And also the challenge of how do I learn about this scientific or technological topic and how can I translate it for a lay audience? How do I make sure that anyone watching PBS at home, whether you're 5 years old or you're 55 years old, if you turn on this show, you're going to learn something today because our team was able to distill it down to the most digestible information so that you walked away a little smarter than before you turned on the TV. So that's the program that an episode of that program won an Emmy. And it, again, I think when you realize that you can do hard things, when you realize that you can help tell stories, that how would you want to receive new information? I think leveraging that skill set and then having that be rewarded, quite literally rewarded with an Emmy statuette, is a very satisfying thing. And I think also winning it as part of a team is a very satisfying thing. You know, these awards have such a halo effect. I think a lot of people think of them as validating, you know, if I could just win an Oscar or, you know, a Tony or an Emmy, you know, whatever it is, then that means I'll really have made it. And I think the truth is you, quote, make it way before you ever get an award, if you ever get an award. Luck has a lot to do with these things. You know, the ability to even submit to be considered for the award has a lot to do with things. So anyway, you know, there's sort of an interest. Awards in and of themselves, I think, are a very interesting topic that could be their very own podcast. But
it's a good point.
Yeah.
Especially in the creative world. Like, how does one thing win over another?
Exactly. It's completely subjective. Like, that's the great joy of art. Especially, I think, relative sometimes to like business, where a lot of things are objective.
Can be more quantified.
Yeah, they can be more quantified. That's perfectly said. versus when you're creating, again, telling a story, you know, how I tell it, how you tell it, I think they're both valid. And so to sort of land this plane, right, it's of course really exciting. I think also one of the funnier things about having an Emmy is when folks come over to my house and they see it and their first reaction is that it's like a gag gift. Like, you know, you can get like a
fake Emmy. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you get like a, you know, like a best mother Oscar at a Hollywood gift shop or something. And they're like, oh, this is so funny. What does it say? And then they see, they're like, oh, it's real. And I'm like, yeah, it's real. So it brings joy, brings a lot of joy.
That's amazing. I love that. So you wound up pursuing business school and kind of making a switch into the business world. And I think it's really a topic that's been coming up a lot on this podcast is this kind of relationship between the creative and the practical sides of ourselves. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about your decision to make a shift more into the business world and how you see those, how you saw those sides of yourself and how you see them now.
Yeah, I love this topic and this question so much because I think as someone who grew up with such reverence for creativity and who frankly really desperately wanted to be an artist, I think what I found out pretty quickly by actually working in a creative space is that the arts are in desperate need of business, which is to say we, you know, we're in a capitalist society. And so to have pure art without good business sense behind it really, unfortunately, isn't feasible. And so when I was still working in public television at the time, I had been a producer for, you know, associate producer for probably 4 years or so. And I had kind of reached a point with it where I wanted more, I wanted to do more. And that, so once again, unexpected sort of fell backwards into an opportunity where I spoke about the program SciTech Now and working with all these different public television stations through that program and seeing what they were producing. What we realized is that there wasn't enough digital infrastructure across public media for us to efficiently receive and package and send back out this type of program where we kind of were leveraging other content from other producers alongside content we were producing ourselves. We needed the digital infrastructure to actually make that happen in a sustainable way. So I wound up on the project team to solve that problem. How is it that we're going to efficiently transfer footage back and forth? How are we going to make this happen? We can't just use file transfer sites that are, you know, third party and not very user friendly for the rest of our existence. What are we going to do about this? So I wound up becoming essentially a product manager, a digital product manager, building this whole new platform built for content sharing and content exchange. And so much went into it. You know, how do we control for intellectual property rights? How do we control for proper licensing? How do we make sure that no one's using footage that is out of rights? How do we make sure that the credits are accurate, right? Like, how do you make sure that if I used footage from Jenna, that Jenna gets into my credit roll? We have to control for all of that on top of the fact that the footage has to be high enough quality for a broadcast environment. So again, a lot of things I knew nothing about. And I said, boy, let me figure this out. And, you know, I ultimately led this team and built this digital product. We launched it. We got 94% of PBS stations onboarded to this before, you know, before I wound up leaving that job. I'm in another job now, of course. But it was this incredible experience in which I realized that if you don't have infrastructure, support, funding, if you don't know how to calculate ROI, or if you don't even know what ROI means, this is where creativity starts to fall apart very quickly. You know, the people who create can't do it unless they have that solid foundation. So I really said to my, you know, my company, my leadership at the time, I said, you know, would you send me to business school? Like, I think I can figure this out. I don't think it has to be creativity or business. I think the two together is where the magic happens. And that's what I'd like to be when I grow up. So that's really why I decided to go to business school. And I think when I went, I had this very clear vision that I would be, you know, CEO of Lincoln Center one day or something like that, you know, and I think that's still in the back of my head is what I'd like to end up doing. Because again, I think for this capitalist society to have excellent art, we need good business sense behind it. We need that foundation.
Yeah, that's such an interesting and important insight, like how important business is to the art world. And also, like, I love your realization that it's not like an either or, it's creativity and business.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think a popular zeitgeisty discourse to say, you know, oh, it's the same 10 people that make all the decisions about the movies we see. about which albums get produced, which albums win Grammys. And I think that's true. It's just a fundamental truth, because I think if you would have more opportunity for people who appreciate, understand, practice the arts that require that business sense, actually helping to make those decisions, that's where diversity comes back into the picture. That's where you start to, his name is escaping me, but the gentleman who wrote the screenplay for American Fiction, is that what it was called? Where, you know, he said, stop making one really, really big blockbuster movie and start making 10 smaller budget movies. I think if you have more people in business decision-making roles that could actually enact that, now you're going to have a lot more diversity in what we all consume. You're going to have a lot more exciting artistic endeavors, and you're going to have a lot more artists in general, instead of just this concentration of, you know, the same 10 people all the time.
And a lot more personalization, right? And art that is like expressive of humans. And now we have AI coming in, and there's so much content that's created by AI, right? But if you have that business sense to connect the art back to the human side of things, then you'll be able to get that more like bifurcated and distributed environment.
100%. And I stand firmly in the position that a creative business person, to be clear, a business person who is also a creative, would never invest in AI for things like script writing or things like creation, because you would have that keen understanding that this is a human experience. The best stories are deeply human. They're not going to be made by robots. It's just, you will not get ROI from an AI written script. It just won't happen. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. What I'm curious, this wasn't in your prep questions, but like just double clicking on the AI question, do you see it being used in different parts of the process, or how do you see that like unfolding?
Ooh, I love that. I mean, the answer is yes. The short answer is yes. There are going to be ways that AI makes a creative's life so much easier. For example, I distinctly remember when I made this film called What Makes a Great Book. This was, talk about like a dream come true, lightning in a bottle type assignment, where literally, you know, PBS has content pillars, right? So you're often making programs that will tie into these content pillars that, again, you have no choice over. But one of the content pillars was The Great American Read. PBS wanted all these, you know, all of America to vote on their favorite book. And so from a local production standpoint, we wanted to create a sort of companion documentary for this pillar. And so I produced a film called What Makes a Great Book, where it was literally just 30 minutes on the craft of writing dialogue, the excitement of reading a particular book. And I know that might sound like watching paint dry when I describe it, but like,
no, not watching you describe it does not sound like that, because I can feel the joy and excitement.
Oh my gosh, it was unbridled joy to work on this film for me. Go look it up, humor me, watch it, let me know what you think. But talking to authors, talking to local bookstore owners, talking to community members, librarians, kids, anyone really, about like, to you, what makes a great book? Oh my gosh. First of all, AI is not going to write that script. It's just not going to do it. It will spit out for you, I'm sure, very eloquent bullet points about what textbooks will tell you that makes a great book.
Or on average, what makes a good book.
Exactly. But it's not about, I mean, look, as someone who owns two copies of Elements of Style, Strunk and White, I love an academic look at, you know, language structure or grammar structure. These things are all good. But what makes a great book is fundamentally human. It's your experience of that book. It's something that AI is not going to get at. Where AI would have been wonderful is, can you please transcribe every interview that I did and do it accurately, right? You know, when I was producing, which from a technical standpoint was 100 years ago at this point, we had transcribing software and it was pretty good, but you'd still spend a lot of time going through and fixing very, very funny typos. So that's a huge help. I think managing the schedule, so much of production is actually not creative at all. It's very project management oriented. So you have to create shoot day schedules, right? Like, you know, if we have 42 minutes for lunch, it's not 45 minutes, it's 42 minutes. Can you help me optimize so that we have a full 45 minute lunch break, right? Using AI to build that, oh, that would be a dream. Instead of me sitting there with my Excel sheet, plugging things in and changing things, I think that would be amazing. I think bringing order and efficiency to the process so that the creative doesn't have to worry about some of those nitty-gritty details and instead could focus on what is the story, how am I telling it the best way. Again, focusing on the truly human aspects of production or of storytelling. If AI could just take care of everything else, that's where you're going to start to see a lot of magic and again, that ROI.
Yeah, no, that's really a good point. And yeah, really helping augment so that the human can focus on the purely creative parts. So I think something that's interesting in the creative, well, in a lot of worlds, is this concept of identity. And I'm curious, like, as you kind of shifted from out of the creative world into the business world, like, what was that like for you to kind of maybe let go of a little bit of that identity? Or is it still something that you hold on to? Like, how does that, like, sit internally for you?
Yeah, wow. That's a big question. It's hard, you know. I'm not like to go from and here's what I'll say. You know, I've had several really, really cool jobs over the last few years that I would put firmly in the, you know, sort of corporate business side of things. And I would say with absolute certainty that it is my creativity that makes me successful in them. I'm not a spreadsheet jockey, right? I think that's the turn of phrase people use sometimes, a spreadsheet jockey. Apologies if it's not, but you know, that's not what I bring to the table. What I bring to the table is all of the ability to do an index match in Excel, but also an ability to question the data that I'm looking at, the ability to start to craft, again, a story around what the data is telling us, the ability to translate that story into a digestible takeaway, right? So again, just like SciTech Now, even if I don't know as much about this, you know, when I was a management consultant, this was the whole name of the game. You might not know anything about the project that you're going into until 20 minutes after you've been staffed on it. And you've just sort of got to get smart really, really quickly. It's the same exact flow. It's the same exact skill set. And so the creativity of it, I think, is so core to my success as somebody in business. But I think also, maybe not but, and also, there is almost a grieving process that comes with having been a full-time creative and moving away from that into a different focus, right? You're being asked to think about different types of outcomes than you might have been asked to think about as a creative. And I think there's absolutely a sort of a loss that you have to mourn with that transition. But I really think now, I love that you're asking me this question now, because I've done a lot of thinking about this over the last 4 years. Of sort of having transitioned into, again, a more business role and career. What makes me successful, what makes so many people successful, is actually not letting that go, not mourning it, and actually saying, no, no, no. We're going to go pitch a client. Give me a pass at this deck. Like, I know how we're going to tell this story, right? Because it's not just what you do, it's how you do it. And I think creatives have this undeniable edge in that how bucket. And so I think really what I've come to understand after a period of feeling that maybe I had to lose it or let it go is that I'm only going to be successful if I embrace it 100%. That's my superpower. And I think all creative people, if you're ever thinking this is a distraction or something like that, no, it's not. You must embrace it because it is your superpower too.
I love that. Yeah. Continuing to hold on to it as part of you.
For sure.
Before we were talking about like the analytical and the creative sides as well. And I'm curious, like, how do those now sit internally now that you've kind of entered this business world? And
yeah, I think it's fun. I think, again, like it's one thing if you know how to run an analysis in whether you're using Excel or something fancier than that, right? You know, if you know how to look at data, that's a skill. But what do you do afterwards, right? Like, Let's talk about business strategy. Let's just talk about that for a second. So
let's talk.
Let's do it. So I was talking earlier about documentaries, right? You have to write to what you have. That's business strategy. What do I know today? How can I make the best possible decisions given what I know today, the best possible information I have today? It's the same thing as making a film, right? How do I tell the best possible story with what I've got on film? And that's the decision that you're going to make. Now, remember I talked about also, you know, if you have a budget for 5 shoots, only use 4, because there's always the opportunity to go get more information. And when you have more information, change the script, change the strategy. You have to be able to go with the flow and adapt based on what you understand. So sort of land this metaphor, right? Like the ability to understand the data is one piece of it. And I think when you, you know, if you're sort of raised in a business mind or you went to school for a business mind, they really teach you that in school, right? Sort of the technical ability to run an analysis and understand what the output is. But where you really excel, where you start to step into a position of leadership in business is when you can see that information and make a decision about it. And then have the openness to change your mind, change your decision when new information becomes available. So I would say today, again, it really feels like a superpower that I can do both, right? I don't have to just look at the output on an analysis and say, that's the answer. I can look at the output on the analysis and say, this is the best answer we've arrived at with what we've got. Am I missing anything? Is there any other story I can go get to supplement this? You know, how can we make a decision today that doesn't block us from making a different decision tomorrow? And that, I think, that entire thought process comes from being a creative.
No, I think you bring up such a good point, because as living through like a creative process, it takes like a certain level of openness, detachment to outcome, practice, like all these things that are really relevant for, to your point, running a business strategy. Yet so often you're assigned to like a very discrete task, so you don't get that full big picture. And so I feel like being able to apply that creative, that like artistic mindset in the business setting is such a differentiator. Yeah. Well, Sasha, let me ask one last question to wrap up here. I'm curious how your view of creativity has changed over the years, or like if any beliefs that you've developed or changed.
Wow. I think when I was, you know, more of a full-time creative, I thought this is a really fun way to live life. I think now that I'm not a full-time creative, I'm a business person who is creative, I have understood that it is essential for happiness, success, however you choose to define those things. But I think what's changed for me is this is no longer something I want to do. It's something that I think everyone needs to do. You know, there's a professor at Columbia Business School who wrote a book called There's No Business That's Not Show Business. He's right. I mean, he's just right. It's just a correct statement. I mean, there is no career or job that anyone has that can't be enriched by creativity, whether that's in your day to day or it's outside of your day to day. Again, there's a lot that AI will take over. There's a lot of business that, you know, quote unquote, the robots are going to take over, right? That's absolutely true. The pieces that are not, that are untouchable, in my opinion, even if we try to let the AI take over, I'm quite confident it will fail in these more human creative aspects of life. And so to me, it has never been more vital or more critical that people embrace their creativity, that people discover it. And if you haven't discovered it yet, go take an acting class, take a dance class, go make some pottery, whatever it might be, go find it. Because I think we are at a point in humanity where that's going to be everything. It's not just what you can do, but how you do it. How do you think? How do you take in the world around you? When you are a creative, I think it's a completely different perspective. So to really answer your question, where I thought it was something that was almost a nice to have with some really, you know, extra value that if you had it, you had this edge and good for you. At this point, I really think it is vital. It is necessary. And I think we aren't humans and we aren't a society without creativity.
I love that. I completely agree. Yeah, I think it's like a fundamental human need. Well, okay, at the beginning, you said you might start some new writing or project. So any new creative projects we can expect from you?
Actually, okay, based on my answer to your last question, what I've really been thinking a lot about is how important this is to cultivate a practice. And I really actually have been thinking about, you know, registering for a creative writing class and just building it into my schedule, right? Like it's hard to carve out time for that. And so sometimes you have to just schedule it, like really put it on the calendar. So I can't say that I have anything in the works right now, but I can say that I need to have something in the works. We all need to have something in the works, right?
I think we all do too.
We need to have it. And so I'm going to embrace my own words and it's going to be in the calendar. So we'll see.
Great. The listeners are going to follow up.
I was going to say, you'll have to follow up with me and then we'll do an update.
I love it. Well, Sasha, thank you so much for being here. This was so wonderful. Seriously, I'm so inspired. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me and thank you for having these conversations, because they are very impactful.
I hope you enjoyed my episode with Sasha. Let me know what you thought of it and what lessons you took away. Thanks so much, and stay tuned for more lessons.